Hello, and welcome to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. We'll start with the death notices and move on to business and sports, then the opinions and editorials, and finish up with today's horoscopes, Dear Abby, and the comics. The death notices in today's Arizona Republic: Richard Dick Ballou, age 88, from Sun Lakes; Robert Norvin Behrens, Bob, 82, from Arizona; Angela Berglund, age 76, from Phoenix; Robert James Bob Jastrab, 73, from Scottsdale; and Jean Bly Reichenbacher, age 92, from Scottsdale. Turning now to the business section of today's Arizona Republic, top of the page, headline, sources say Tesla IT exec now heads sales. Jagannathan thought to have no sales experience. A relatively little-known information technology executive is running Tesla's sales team as the electric car maker grapples with a drop in sales, according to people familiar with the matter. Raj Jagannathan, a senior executive with a wide purview, including several IT and data functions, recently took over the sales role, said the people familiar with the matter. Some inside Tesla have interpreted this to mean that Jagannathan has assumed the role of Troy Jones, Tesla's top sales executive in North America, until he departed earlier this month after 15 years with the company, said the people. Jagannathan, who has recently grown closer to CEO Elon Musk, has no traditional sales experience, according to two people familiar with that matter and his LinkedIn profile. Demand for Tesla's cars in Europe and North America has dropped sharply. Last quarter, its quarterly sales plunged 13% to the weakest in nearly 3 years due to a backlash to Musk's politics, Tesla's aging vehicle lineup, and increased competition from rivals offering more affordable alternatives. Tesla did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Jones, the latest in a string of high-level departures, managed the fallout as Musk's political affiliation with President Donald Trump prompted left-leaning consumers to shun Tesla. As Tesla's sales were dropping earlier this year, Jones implored managers to work on selling and pushed back against concerns over political headwinds related to Musk, according to a person who heard the comment. Other key figures who recently left include Musk's confidant, Omid Afshar, who was in charge of sales and manufacturing operations in North America and Europe, Milan Kovac, the head of Tesla's Optimus humanoid robot team, said he was leaving in June. Jagannathan has spent 13 years at Tesla in tech roles. He joined in 2012 as a senior staff engineer with responsibilities for internet traffic and cloud security, according to his LinkedIn page. More recently, he has helped develop Tesla's data center effort in Texas, two people familiar with the matter said. Continuing with the business section, prices of popular menu items are up in June. Coffee, beer, and burgers top the list. That dinner out for the family or your next date night meal might cost a little more, according to the latest look at June menu price changes calculated by digital technology platform Toast. According to the June Menu Price Monitor, menu prices of some popular items remain higher than a year ago. For the month of June, the median price of a premium cup of coffee, cold brew, beer, and a burger have all crept up. Two items on the menu are slightly cheaper, burritos and wings. The median price of a cup of regular coffee remained unchanged from May, according to the survey. As restaurants try to navigate the current climate, inflation and rising costs are top of mind. Brian Korber, principal of brand journalism and news at Toast, told USA Today. Restaurants are using various strategies to deal with inflation, Korber said, including increasing prices, conducting profit analysis, adjusting food suppliers, tracking ingredient costs, and managing inventory. Consumers spent more at restaurants than at grocery stores over the past several months, according to a new analysis and report by the Bank of America Institute. Grocery spending has lagged restaurant spending since March and is up 1% year over year in June compared with 2.1% in 2024, according to aggregated credit card and debit card data from Bank of America. However, in contrast to the spending data, when customers were asked what they have done recently to reduce expenses, they said they were cutting spending at restaurants. Bank of America aggregated data shows households increased their spending at full-service restaurants and also how often they dined out in June. Looking across Bank of America card data, we see households made fewer visits to quick-service restaurants, QSRs, and increased the number of transactions at full-service casual dining spots in June on a year-over-year growth basis, the report said. Additionally, the spending growth per transaction for lower-income households was greater than other income levels at both limited and full-service dining, the report said. But the growth in the number of transactions was much lower in June, suggesting the first pullback in spending could come in the number of trips, but not necessarily the money spent, the report said. And U.S. airlines win with premium travel plans. Demand slump affects regular ticket sales. U.S. airlines doubled down on high-end travel after the pandemic to drive up profits and reduce their vulnerability to economic swings. The strategy is paying off as the margins of carriers selling premium seats have held up despite a slump in overall travel demand. Strong demand from affluent travelers is helping airlines offset a pullback in spending by customers who are limited by price. Delta Airlines in mid-July reported a 5% year-over-year jump in its second quarter premium ticket revenue, compared to a 5% decline in main cabin revenue. The 10 percentage point gap was the widest since the pandemic, helping it post a double-digit margin in the April-June quarter. Similarly, premium cabin revenue helped United Airlines mitigate the financial hit from operational constraints at Newark Airport near New York City, one of its largest hubs, and increase its earnings in the latest quarter. United's premium revenue rose 5.6% in the June quarter from a year ago. Its overall passenger revenue grew just 1.1%. The industry saw a similar trend in the first quarter when President Donald Trump's sweeping tariffs raised the specter of an economic recession, hammering airline bookings. Premium capacity remains resilient, said United's chief commercial officer, Andrew Nocella. Airline executives have attributed the resilient demand for premium travel to the healthy financial conditions of U.S. households with earnings of $100,000, which account for 75% of air travel spending. While an April sell-off in financial markets after Trump announced tariffs raised the risk of undermining that demand, a sharp rebound in U.S. stocks since then has eased those concerns. Our core consumer is in good shape and continues to prioritize travel, Delta CEO Ed Bastian said in mid-July. In contrast, lingering uncertainty about the broader economy and rising living costs have taken a toll on demand from less affluent customers. Bank of America data shows while spending by middle and higher income households held up in June, lower income household spending turned negative. Low-fare carrier JetBlue Airways told staff in June that it was planning new cost-cutting measures as soft demand made achieving a break-even operating margin in 2025 unlikely, according to an internal memo seen by Reuters. Summer travel season tends to be the most profitable for carriers, but weak demand for main cabin seats has forced airlines to offer sales to fill planes. Discount carriers such as Frontier and Spirit Airlines are aggressively slashing flights to prevent more discounting pressure. Airline executives say premium cabins have become the profit differentiator in the industry. Since premium travelers tend to be less price sensitive, carriers expect them to be less affected by economic shifts, making their spending more stable and offering a buffer in a downturn. At Delta, premium revenue accounted for 43% of passenger revenue in the June quarter, up from 35% in 2019. It's helped the Atlanta-based carrier become a pre-tax margin leader post-pandemic. The company expects its revenue from premium cabins to surpass that from the main cabins in 2027. Diversified revenues, including from premium cabins, have helped shares of Delta and United outperform the broader industry in the past 2 years. Encouraged by the payoff, carriers are further ramping up investments to make their premium offerings more attractive. United has unveiled new premium suites with privacy doors on its new Boeing 787-9 planes. The suites will have 27-inch screens, luxury skincare amenities, and caviar and wine pairings. Alaska Airlines is on track to increase the share of premium seats on its flights to 29% by next summer, from 26% currently. Faced with weak margins, budget airlines are now trying to tap into the high-end market. JetBlue, which has reported a profit in just two of its last 9 quarters, is putting first-class seats on domestic flights and opening its first airport lounges in New York and Boston. Frontier is retrofitting the first 2 rows of its aircraft with first-class seats. Spirit, long known for its no-frills service, is seeking to rebrand itself as a premium airline to turn around its business. The number of premium seats in the U.S. domestic market has increased by 14% since 2019, more than 3 times the growth in main cabin seats, according to data from Visual Approach Analytics. The rush to add premium seats is hampering aircraft deliveries. It also risks causing a supply glut, hurting pricing power. But Alaska CEO Ben Minicucci downplayed those concerns, saying the premium travel is more about an experience than a seat. We see it as an end-to-end premium experience that people will pay for and people expect, he said. And time now to turn to the sports section of today's Arizona Republic. That game, Diamondbacks game, it was a late game on the 21st, Astros 6, D-backs 3. Gallen and the Diamondbacks stumble below 500 again. If the Arizona Diamondbacks do end up selling and their 6-3 loss to the Houston Astros on Monday night, July 21st, likely push them a bit more in that direction. They figure they have a handful of appealing targets for contending clubs, evidenced by the growing number of rival scouts making their way to Chase Field in recent days. But after he turned in a disappointing performance against the Astros, his latest in a season filled with them, it's fair to wonder just how appealing right-hander Zach Gallen is becoming. In 6-plus innings, Gallen gave up 6 earned runs. He left too many pitches over the heart of the plate and paid the price for it. He allowed 8 balls in play at 95 miles per hour or harder that were hit on line or in the air. It was not a recipe for success. The loss dropped the Diamondbacks back under 500. They are 50-51. The outcome also cost them a game in the wild card race. They fell to 5.5 games back of the San Diego Padres, who are in position for the 3rd wild card spot. The Diamondbacks would need to pass 4 teams in order to reach the postseason. Eugenio Suarez, fresh off being named the National League Player of the Week, went deep again, drilling a solo homer on a low liner to left in the 3rd, his 36th this season. But the Diamondbacks failed to come through with runners in scoring position several times in late innings. They left the bases loaded in the 6th and stranded 2 runners in each of the final 2 innings. Astros rookie Bryce Matthews, playing in his 5th big league game, slammed the first 2 home runs of his career. Both shots came off Gallen and accounted for 5 of the 6 runs he allowed. In the 2nd, Matthews sent a belt-high fastball out to left for a 3-run homer to give the Astros a 3-1 lead. In the 7th, he hit a down-the-middle cutter out for a two-run shot, extending the Astros' lead 6-3. It feels like every time I make a mistake, it turns into a home run, which is unfortunate, Gallen said. It's hard to keep runs off the board when balls are leaving the ballpark. I don't know what the fix is there. I just feel like I've been in spots before where I've made mistakes and kind of gotten away with it. It's just kind of how the game goes. It's a humbling game, and it'll get you. As recently as a couple weeks ago, Gallen appeared to be on the verge of turning his year around. He struck out 10 in 7 strong innings against the Giants on July 1st, then followed that by striking out 9 in 6 innings against the Padres on July 7th. but he's fallen off again in the past two, allowing a combined 12 runs in 11 innings. In 121 innings this season, Gallen has allowed 75 earned runs, the second highest total in the majors. He's had 8 starts this season in which he has allowed 5 earned runs or more. He had 9 such outings combined in 2022 and 2023. He finished in the top 5 of Cy Young balloting both years. If an acquiring team were willing to give up something of value for Gallen, it would be banking on him recapturing his previous form. More than likely, right-hander Merrill Kelly, who's having a strong season, would be the more coveted asset. The Diamondbacks, of course, are still hoping to avoid that outcome. Gallen said he senses the looming deadline. The Diamondbacks have 8 games left before July 31st, which is an off day, being a motivator for the team. I think just from a team standpoint, we're trying to answer the bell and play a little bit better and give the front office and ownership a reason to add, Gallen said. We feel like we still have good talent in this room. The upcoming pitching matchups are not shaping up kindly. In the second game against the Astros, they will face lefty Framber Valdez, one of the better left-handed pitchers in baseball. And they line up to likely face Pirates right-hander Paul Skeens in Pittsburgh this weekend and Tigers lefty Tarik Sukhbal in Detroit next week. Which is to say, if the Diamondbacks are going to avoid a sell-off, it isn't going to be easy. We know what these next 8 games mean, said Torey Lovello. We're going to go out there and do our best. And Christian Walker emerged as a solid major league player who forged his path to becoming sought after in free agency through 6 full seasons with the Diamondbacks. On July 21st, he returned to Chase Field for the first time in another uniform, that of the visiting Houston Astros. Walker, a 3-time Gold Glove winner who became a fan favorite and a major clubhouse presence, was in the lineup at first base for the Astros against the Diamondbacks in the opener of their 3-game series. Walker doubled in a run for the Astros in the 3rd inning. He was cheered for his first at bat and heard louder cheers for a tribute video played in the middle of the 2nd inning. Mostly just excited about seeing the guys, former teammates, Walker said before the game. I've kept in touch with a few of them over the course of the year, but to be able to give some hugs and shake some hands with people I haven't seen in a while will be good. Walker spent parts of 8 seasons with the Diamondbacks. The feeling that he belonged as a major leaguer and found some job security at first base came from his time in Phoenix, he said. That's really a special place to be as a player growing up, Walker said. As somebody who had a late start to his career, that was a big milestone for me. I always felt like if I got a real opportunity, I could prove myself. Walker said he was following the Diamondbacks more in the beginning of the season, but as his focus has turned to being better acclimated to the Astros, that has waned. Walker didn't get much into what happened in free agency and how he chose the Astros instead of re-signing with Arizona. He said there wasn't an official offer made from the Diamondbacks, even though he did circle back with them after drawing interest from other teams. It wasn't much of a decision, Walker said. Houston was interested. We were very interested in the city. They matched the number we were looking for, and that's it. It was an easy decision, but it felt like it was the right one for sure. And Gabriel Moreno needs more time for fracture to heal. A scan on catcher Gabriel Moreno's fractured finger showed the injury has not fully healed, manager Torey Lovello said, adding that Moreno is likely 2 weeks away from resuming baseball activities. The healing has progressed, not significantly, but as expected, Lovello said. Still not completely healed to the point where we can begin full baseball activity. Moreno suffered the injury when a wild pitch caught his right pointer finger on June 6th in Cincinnati. Initial tests did not reveal the fracture, and Moreno tried to play through the discomfort. The fracture was discovered in subsequent tests 2 weeks later. That Moreno is still not able to resume activities is disappointing development for the Diamondbacks, though they have managed to handle his absence well enough with a combination of Jose Herrera and James McCann. In the past few days, catcher Adrian Del Castillo has joined the team as well and figures to continue to get starts at both catcher and DH. And Shelby Miller continues quick progress from injury. Right-hander Shelby Miller will throw a live batting practice session on July 22nd, according to Lovello, who did not rule out the possibility that Miller could return from the injured list shortly after that. "I don't know that answer, but I'm hoping it will be a fast turnaround as possible," Lovello said when asked what Miller's next step would be if all goes well in the live session. If there's another live or a game has yet to be determined, but "what I was told is, during the bullpen, the stuff came out real hot," he said. Miller landed on the injured list on July 7th with a right forearm strain. He had been an integral part of the club's bullpen, logging a 1.98 ERA in 6 1/3 innings with 11 walks and 40 strikeouts. Meanwhile, left-hander Jalen Beeks is expected to throw another bullpen session on July 22nd. He is trying to return from a back issue. And Diamondbacks agree to terms with draft picks. The Diamondbacks announced they have agreed to terms with most of their 20 picks from last week's draft. Top pick Cason Cunningham and pitchers Patrick Forbes and Brian Curley, all day one draft choices, top the group of eventual signees. 11 of the Diamondbacks' 14 second-day picks also agreed to terms, starting with fourth-rounder Dean Livingston, a right-handed pitcher. Here are the other players who agreed. Fifth round, 153rd overall, O.F. Nathan Hall, University of South Carolina. Sixth round, 183rd overall, right-hand pitcher Sawyer Hawks from Vanderbilt. Seventh round, 213th overall, left-handed pitcher Joe Arriola from Wake Forest. Eighth round, 243rd overall, right-handed pitcher Jack Martinez from Arizona State. Ninth round, 273rd overall, I.F. Wallace Clark from Duke. 10th round, 303rd overall, I.F. Brady Council from Kansas. 11th round, 333rd overall, left-handed pitcher Luke Dotson from Mississippi State. 12th round, 363rd overall, left-handed pitcher Taylor Montiel from Tulane. 13th round, 393rd overall, right-handed pitcher Alex Galvin from Central Florida. 15th round and 453rd overall, right-handed pitcher Hayden Murphy from Auburn. 16th round and 483rd overall, right-handed pitcher Colin Rothermel from Jacksonville. 17th round, 513th overall, right-handed pitcher Joel Sarver from UNC Charlotte. And 18th round, 543rd overall, right-handed pitcher Raul Garizar from Arizona. Turning now to basketball, Brittany Griner returns to Phoenix, where she built her legend. Former Phoenix Mercury star Brittany Griner has been busy since exploring free agency for the first time in her 11-year career and ultimately choosing the Atlanta Dream. Griner has been living a full life as she enters the twilight years of her surefire Hall of Fame career. From raising a child to learning a new system and new teammates, Griner has adjusted to her new home. Earlier this season, the 34-year-old surpassed Lisa Leslie in career blocks and leads the Dream with 1.3 blocks per game. Griner and the Dream visit the Mercury at Phoenix Arena for a 7 p.m. game Wednesday, July 23rd, which is today. The hope is that the X Factor gives her a ton of love, head coach Nate Tibbetts said. "What she's meant to this organization and city is going to be hard to match. She's one of one. BG is a special person and we'll all be excited to see her." Griner and her wife welcomed their baby boy on July 8, 2024, not long before Griner played in the WNBA All-Star Game at Phoenix Arena and went off to the Paris Olympics. Having the game in Phoenix helped Griner and her wife with additional assistance from family members in town. However, she admitted that it was hard to leave her newborn, Bash, but she said he'd understand when he gets older because he's definitely going to grow up in a sports house. Fellow parent and teammate Diana Taurasi said before the All-Star Game that Griner didn't need her parenting advice because of who she is. "BG is the kindest, warm-hearted, gentle, caring person I have ever been around. I think that's why you see the love and admiration for her everywhere she goes, because that's who she is," Taurasi said. Since choosing the Dream in free agency, Griner has found a new home for her young family. Bash has become a familiar face in Atlanta, whether it's sitting with Griner during post-game conferences or wearing matching jerseys. Following a win against the Chicago Sky on June 13th, Griner, with Bash on her lap, credited him as her why in life. "It was starting to get to a point where I was like, what is my why? Honestly. And then he came along, and yeah, he's my why," Griner said. "Like, everything I do is for him. I'll be proud of him once he's able to really realize everything. But yeah, no, he's my why. He's my everything. I do it for him. I want to provide for him and, you know, show him the right way to do things." To celebrate her return, the Mercury will hold Bee Gees Heart and Soul Shoe Drive at Phoenix Arena, where fans can donate new and gently used shoes. Griner started the charity in 2016 in Phoenix and has held shoe drives at games since. "It's going to be amazing. What Bee Gee has done for this organization since she came in as a rookie, it's amazing," Kaylee Copper said. "I think this organization has done a great job of the rollout thus far for her coming back, and I'm excited for the X Factor to go out there and give her that standing ovation she deserves." And some notes. The All-Star break gave the shorthanded Mercury time to rest and relax. At the first practice on Monday, July 21st, Copper, hamstring, Satu Sabali, ankle, and Lexi Held, pneumothorax, were full participants. Copper and Sabali had their first live action since their injuries on July 3rd. "It's a lot," Cooper said. "Going through the knee injury and then being fine and finally getting back out there and feeling like yourself, and then the hamstring. It's annoying. It comes with it, and I'm just trying to make sure I'm doing the things that I'm supposed to do, and I'll be fine." Tibbetts said all three are day-to-day, and the medical staff will evaluate how they feel after each practice. The Mercury went 1-1 in the week leading up to the All-Star break, losing a road contest to the Minnesota Lynx on July 16th. "The last two games were fun, but it's tough playing with eight," Tibbetts said. "We need their energy, and you could feel it on Monday. They're a little bit rested and excited to get going. It's great to have them out there." The three continued their recovery at practice on Tuesday, July 22nd. And continuing with basketball, Chris Paul won't be returning to the Phoenix Suns for a reunion after all. He agreed to join the Los Angeles Clippers on a veteran minimum on July 21st. The Suns have two roster spots open to make up for the total 15 for guaranteed contracts, and they still need another true point guard. The tandem of Devin Booker and Jalen Green is the team's projected starting backcourt. The Suns only have Colin Gillespie at the one behind Booker, primarily a shooting guard, who's handled the point for much of the past two seasons. The Suns are under the first league tax apron by $10.7 million after waiving and stretching Bradley Beal's contract on July 16th. Beal has since joined the Clippers, per salary switch. The same figure equals what they have for a mid-level exception as a result. Spending more than $5.7 million of that $10.7 million would hard cap Phoenix at the first apron. With the NBA in the fourth week of free agency, here are four available point guards Phoenix could consider signing prior to training camp. 1, Russell Westbrook. He's 36 years old, 17 years a player, 6'4". The 2024-25 averages with the Denver Nuggets, 13.3 points per game, 6.1 assists, 4.9 rebounds, 1.4 steals, 1.9 assist-to-turnover ratio, 27.9 minutes in 36 starts, and 75 games played. Career averages, 21.2 points, 7.0 rebounds, 8.0 assists, and 1.6 steals. Also, there's Malcolm Brogdon. He's 32 years old and has played for 9 years. He's 6'4". His 2024-25 averages with the Wizards, 12.7 points per game, 4.1 APG, 3.7 RPG, 2.7 ATO, career low 23.5 minutes in 24 games, 13 starts. Career averages, 15.3 points per game, 4.7 assists per game, 4.1 rebounds per game, 2.6 ATO. And also looking at Ben Simmons. He's 29 and has played for 7 years. Height is 6'10". His averages for 24-25 combined with Brooklyn Nets and the Clippers, 5 points per game, 5.5 assists per game, 4.7 rebounds in 22 minutes. Career averages, 13.1 points per game, 7.4 rebounds per game, 7.2 assists per game, 1.5 steals, and 55.8% shooting. And finally, Jared Butler. He's 24 years old. He's played for 4 years. He's 6'3", has 24-25 average with the Philadelphia 76ers and the Wizards, 9 points per game, 3.7 assists, 0.448, 0.3355, 0.824 splits, and 2.8 ATO. You're listening to the second hour of today's Arizona Republic on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. And time now for the columns and opinions section of today's Arizona Republic. We'll start with E.J. Montini, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Need a bag of money for free? Reports show families are hoarding ESA funds. It was bad enough when State School Superintendent Tom Horn allowed families collecting school voucher cash to burn $1 million in empowerment scholarship account money on Lego purchases, including $1,800 for a limited edition Star Wars Superstar Destroyer, $905 for a Titanic set, and $900 for a Harry Potter castle. It was bad when we found out that ESA money had also purchased dune buggies and golf simulators and fancy watches, and that even more ESA money, your money, bought pianos, luxury car driving lessons, and appliances that freeze-dry food, along with passes to the Arizona Snowball Ski Resort, Ninja Warrior training centers, trampoline parks, and climbing gyms. Then, because Horn's people couldn't keep up with the requests and the Republican-controlled legislature refused to apply restraints or oversight on ESA spending, Horn decided that the department would automatically reimburse education voucher purchases for $2,000 or less. Yes, automatically. Instead of competently dealing with what Horn called the terrible backload on reimbursements, he essentially put a big fat wallet stuffed with cash on a public park bench under a neon sign reading, "Take whatever you need, up to $2,000, no questions asked." Then it got worse. The nonpartisan Grand Canyon Institute found that some families who were collecting school voucher cash were hoarding it, sitting on millions of unspent public dollars. The report said in part, "The intended use of ESA vouchers is to educate a child, not to accumulate balances that carry over year after year. But increasingly, students are receiving very high voucher amounts that parents accumulate rather than spending on their child's education." Now, 12 News I-Team reporter Craig Harris is reporting that public records actually show that families have accumulated more than $440 million in unused ESA money. He reports that more than 10,000 accounts are sitting on at least $10,000 each. Nearly 200 people have more than $100,000 each. And that 10 accounts for more than $200,000 each, with one account at $261,159. Imagine that. Keep in mind that we still have no idea what was purchased with all of those no questions asked approvals of purchases less than $2,000. Stating the obvious, Governor Katie Hobbs told 12 News, "This is yet another indicator of why we need common sense guardrails. I don't think any taxpayer, even taxpayers who support ESAs, and a lot of them do, would support this." I'd guess she's right. But the Republicans who control the legislature and who have the ability to rein in the unchecked ESA spending simply do not care. They apparently hate public schools so much and care so little about wasting taxpayer money that they're willing to allow the ESA program to bankrupt the state. And so are we, when you think about it, if we keep electing them. And that was written by E.J. Montini for the Arizona Republic. You can reach Montini at ed.montini, M-O-N-T-I-N-I, at arizonarepublic.com. The next opinion is written by Stephen Richer and Josh Haywood. Nuclear power meets Arizona's needs. state's electricity use will grow 60% over the next 30 years. Phoenix just hit a record-breaking 118 degrees, and energy demand soared statewide. Yet, Arizona's utilities kept the power on. That's an underappreciated feat, and one that hasn't been consistently accomplished by states like California and Texas. But that success masks a deeper challenge. Arizona's energy demand isn't just rising, it's accelerating. The Common Sense Institute projects Arizona's electricity use will grow 60% over the next 30 years. Without increasing energy supply, increased energy demand will translate to higher prices. And indeed, that's what's happening. Arizona's three largest utilities, APS, SRP, and TEP, are raising or preparing to raise rates. It's tempting to blame the utilities or the Arizona Corporation Commission, both of whom are popular punching bags, but we simply need more power. Natural gas currently fuels nearly half of Arizona's power demand. There are numerous projects underway to supplement natural gas energy with wind energy and solar energy. That's great, but those projects have yet to produce city-powering magnitudes of power. Fortunately, there's already a proven, large, reliable, stable power source that we should increase: nuclear. Arizona is already a nuclear success story. For nearly 40 years, the Palo Verde Generating Station has operated 24/7, rain or shine. Palo Verde can power millions of homes, meaning its energy output dwarfs Arizona's largest solar projects. Palo Verde has run safely for decades. Zero fatalities, zero major incidents. Thanks to Chernobyl and The Simpsons, people have long worried about radiation exposure from nuclear generators. But living within 50 miles of a nuclear power plant exposes you to less radiation than does a cross-country flight or an x-ray at the dentist's office. And the waste? It's a common concern, but all the nuclear waste ever produced in the U.S. could fit on a single football field, stacked about 10 yards high. It's highly regulated and safely stored. The atoms have aligned to make this time for Arizona to invest in nuclear power. Recent technological advances, such as the one by NuScale Power, have made it faster, safer, and far less expensive to bring new generating stations online. Both the Biden administration and the new Trump administration have promoted nuclear power by streamlining the approval process at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and funding American-made small modular nuclear reactors. And popular sentiment has turned pro-nuclear. Pew Research Center ran a poll in June and found that about 60% of Americans support more nuclear power plants to generate electricity. Arizona is booming. TSMC, Intel, and LG are investing billions in high-tech facilities. Corporations announce moves to Arizona every month. We are the 14th biggest state by population, and we have been one of the fastest-growing states every year since rebounding from the 2008 market crash. This all means that Arizonans will have more job opportunities, more dollars for education, more cultural opportunities, and more Diamondbacks fans. I can't stand it when the Dodgers or Cubs fill our ballpark, says in parentheses. But it also means we will use more power. Every person in Arizona uses power. Every person in Arizona pays for power. And for many Arizonans, the price of power is a significant factor in what they can and cannot afford every year. We need to meet Arizona's growing demand. We need more power, and it's time to go nuclear. And that was written by Stephen Richer and Josh Haywood. Stephen Richer is a former Maricopa County recorder. He is now the CEO of Republic Affairs, where Josh Haywood is operations manager. The next opinion comes from Elvia Diaz, columnist for the Arizona Republic. RFK should know better than to hike in Arizona summer. Camelback Mountain is apparently a proving ground for denim-clad daredevils with high government jobs. The nation's highest-ranking health cabinet appointee, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., hiked Camelback Mountain in Phoenix in July in jeans on purpose. Not because his luggage got lost or anything like that, but because Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary apparently felt invincible in extreme Arizona heat. He survived and recorded the moment with a pic, sweaty in his jeans and looking miserable. I can't help but laugh at the hell he must have gone through. But hiking Camelback is no joke at any time of the year and could be deadly in the summer heat. The trail Kennedy and his son hiked is labeled extremely difficult by the city of Phoenix and comes with warnings like, quote, only for experienced hikers during optimal conditions, unquote. Each year, Phoenix emergency crews perform dramatic helicopter rescues for people who think it's a good idea to brave the heat. The irony, or stupidity, of Kennedy's daredevil adventure is the fact that he runs the very agency tasked with advising people not to do things like this. You know, the one that oversees the CDC, FDA, and basically every federal acronym that screams, don't hike up a desert mountain in extreme heat dressed in jeans. The hike, which Kennedy documented on X, because nothing says good judgment like bragging about dangerous heat risk behavior on social media, shows him and his son on the summit at mid-morning, the time when Phoenix fire officials warn against hiking. And just to turn the dial on irony, Kennedy was in Arizona just a few months ago promoting a health agenda and warning against ultra-processed foods. Bold talk from a guy whose heat stroke prevention strategy appears to be to sweat it out in Phoenix's scorching sun. Who in their right mind would listen to this guy? And that was written by Elvia Diaz. She is the editorial page editor for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. You can reach her at elvia.diaz, that's D-I-A-Z, at arizonarepublic.com. And the last opinion in this section is written by Joanna Allhands, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Move summer vacation to winter for Phoenix kids. Why do kids in Metro Phoenix even have a summer break? They should be in school. Wait, hear me out. This might make sense. Summer isn't what it used to be. It's hotter now, with more stretches of 110 degree plus weather. You can play outside, but not in the heat of day, and never for long. If the sunburn doesn't get kids, the quick dehydration will. Pools aren't the cooling savior they once were either. Only about one in three houses have them nowadays, and splash pads take time off work to visit. Boredom quickly takes a toll. Either your house is a wreck from whatever your kids get into, again, because you can't just send them outside and they have to do something, or you cave and give them more screen time to keep them quiet. Double this effect when friends come over to play. Presuming there are even friends around to play, parents who can afford it often use this time to travel out of state. Many also send their kids from camp to camp in the summer to keep them occupied. But again, isn't that steady stream of organized activity kind of like school? I know. We have this idyllic idea of summer, that kids should be spending their vacations lazing about outside under a tree, watching the clouds go by. But that's just not reality in a blazing desert like this one. Plenty of folks complain about the summer being too short, that the school year keeps starting earlier. We shouldn't be back to school shopping on the 4th of July. And hey, I get it. My kid starts back this week. Others already have a week of school under their belts. Even the later starting schools are back in session by early to mid-August, drawing plenty of head-scratching from people on the coasts who don't start until after Labor Day. But think of it this way. Summer in Metro Phoenix is like winter for everyone else. And what do kids do in winter? They go to school. People in colder climates would never dream of keeping kids out of school for 2 months in the middle of January. They'd get cabin fever. Well, same concept here. So why don't we take a 2 week break in summer here? We could time it around the 4th of July, sort of how most schools pause for a couple of weeks around Christmas, and then we could have our summer break in November and December, or save it for February and March when the weather is more bearable. I know the answer as well as you do. We keep our kids home for weeks in the heat because it would force people to rework their vacations and move camps to other times of the year. It would be tough to schedule sports because no one in their right mind would ever play a football game, even one under Friday night lights in July. It could also cost more to cool cash-strapped schools that are normally vacant in summer, among any number of other reasons not to do this. Change is hard, especially when that change would make Metro Phoenix the odd one out nationally. Then again, we relish our standalone status as the only state in the continental U.S. to not observe daylight savings time. So maybe it's not that weird of an idea after all, especially if, you know, we did it for the kids. That was written by Joanna Allhands. You can reach her at Joanna, that's J-O-A-N-N-A, dot Allhands, A-L-L-H-A-N-D-S, at ArizonaRepublic.com. And time now to turn to the horoscopes for today. If you're an Aries, born between March 21st and April 19th, is the gift of gab helping or hurting your workflow? As Venus squares Mars, channel your words into productivity. And for Taurus, April 20th to May 20th, a hobby can become lucrative when Venus activates Mars. Are you ready to turn ideas into yields? And Gemini, born between May 21st and June 21st, friction on the home front? Be the bridge builder as Venus confronts Mars. For Cancer, June 22nd to July 22nd, relating may not go smoothly today. Venus challenging Mars sends out mixed messages. And for Leo, born between July 23rd and August 22nd, networking can lead you to a payday. Chat with people who can provide support that you can follow up on. For Virgo, born between August 23rd and September 22nd, drawing people over to your side, your professional world can benefit from verbal persuasion as Venus activates Mars. For Libra, born between September 23rd and October 23rd, seeking connection but acting withdrawn, your desires may misalign when you think too much about what to do. For Scorpio, born between October 24th and November 21st, cerebral sparks are flying. Bring your heads together as Venus activates Mars. For Sagittarius, born between November 22nd and December 21st, working in a partnership can fuel your ambitions. Come together to take strategic action as Venus squares off with Mars. For Capricorn, born between December 22nd and January 19th, creative problem solving is your strong suit today. Is an underlying tension pushing you to refine and expand your productivity? For Aquarius, born between January 20th and February 18th, feeling magnetic? Attraction levels skyrocket as Venus triggers Mars today. Go where you're pulled. For Pisces, born between February 19th and March 20th, being pushed to do something? Your comfort levels may be on a fence as Venus creates conflict with Mars. And time now for Dear Abby, Abigail Van Buren. First letter. Dear Abby, I'm a divorced man in my 60s. 12 years ago, a neighbor woman who I'm attracted to popped into my house to have a smoke break out on my back deck. When she arrived, I was in the shower. She came in like she always did. She had permission. And walked over to the fireplace. As she turned, she took 2 steps and froze, because at that same moment, I came out of the shower, 5 feet from my bedroom. I was naked. I froze as she looked at me. Abby, she looked me straight in the eye, and then her gaze dropped to my groin. It stayed there for about 2 seconds. Then she gave me a smile, turned away, and went out on my deck like nothing had happened. I can't forget that day. My heart was pounding the way it does the first time you meet someone. She was and still is married. That's why I didn't approach her, even though I kind of wish I had. I haven't been with a woman since my divorce 16 years ago, which may be why I still think about it. We're still friends and nothing like that has happened since, even though I wish it would happen tomorrow. This is the first time I have confided this to anyone. We never talk about that heart-pounding day. What do you suggest? Signed, Hidden Feelings in Pennsylvania. Dear Hidden, I suggest you get back in that shower and turn the cold water on full blast. My next suggestion is to start looking at dating sites because I think you are more than ready. And the next letter. Dear Abby, my grandmother and I are very close. She is 83 and super independent. She loves keeping busy and is always running around town. I need your advice on how to get through to her. She's always driven like a cowboy. She speeds and is impatient on the road. If she sees someone jaywalking, she'll speed up to scare them, as she puts it. It's dangerous and worrisome. I've told her many times that she's driving dangerously, but her reply is that she's never gotten into an accident, so why would she now? Her agility and reflexes are declining as she's aging, and I'm scared she'll hurt someone or herself if she keeps driving this way. How can I get her to take seriously this plea to drive more safely? Signed, Scared in Canada. Dear Scared, in some jurisdictions in the United States, a driver could be charged with an attempted vehicular assault, even if the intent was to scare a pedestrian. Consult an attorney familiar with the vehicle codes in Canada and ask if this is also true there. Because her judgment is so poor, your aggressively driving grandmother should not be behind the wheel. Whether she's willing to admit it or not, at 83, her reaction time has slowed down. What she fails to take into consideration is that not all pedestrians react the same way when a car barrels toward them. While some might jump out of the way, others may freeze and be badly injured or killed. And if you'd like to contact Dear Abby, you can reach her at www.dearabby.com. And time now for some comics. We'll start with Blondie. Dagwood is standing in front of his dog, and the dog is just staring at the bowl of food. Dagwood's got his arms crossed, looking down, and he says, "What do you think of the new dog food, girl?" And Daisy the dog just gives this really loud woof. And Dagwood's got his hands on his hips, and he says, "I don't know if that was a good woof or a bad woof, but the bowl is empty, so it's probably a good woof." And next up, Beetle Bailey. Miss Buxley is at her desk with her computer up, and the corporal comes in, and she says to him, "The general can't see you now." He says, "Why not?" And from the general's office comes a loud ho-hum, and she says, "He's about to take his nap." And in Zitz, two of Jeremy's friends, who are girls, are at his house and come up to his mother and say, "Mrs. Duncan, we need your kitchen for a cook-off." She says, "Say more." She said, "Jeremy and Pierce against Dijon and me. You can watch." And Mom says, "Is heckling permitted?" And one of the girls says, "Encouraged." In Hagar the Horrible, Hagar is talking to the monk, and the monk says, "Hagar, I want you to be a force for good." And Hagar says, "I already am. When have I ever done anything that wasn't good for me?" In Baby Blues, Hammy is making a list. He's got a clipboard and a pencil. He's talking to Zoe, and he says, "I'm making a list of everything I need to do to make this a good summer." And then he looks up at her and says, "Have I tried to freak you out with a dead worm yet?" And she says, "Yes." And Hammy says, "What if I put you under oath?" And she walks away and says, "Asked and answered." And in Pickles, Opal is standing in the middle of the kitchen, sniffing, trying to smell something. She puts her hands on her hips and says, "Okay, who didn't put the lid back on the cookie jar?" She walks into the living room where Earl is sitting in his chair, as usual. And she says, "It was you, Mr. Cookie Breath." He looks up at her and says, "Ah, Miss Marple, I presume." In The Born Loser, Thornapple is at a diner, and he's looking at the menu, and the waitress comes over and says, "Today's special is Eggs Benedict, an English muffin topped with a poached egg, hollandaise, and Canadian bacon." And Thornapple says, "You know, I have always wondered what the difference is between Canadian bacon and American bacon." And the waitress says, "I think it's just the accent." In Pearls Before Swine, the pig and the goat are talking. The pig asks the goat, "Do you still have that friend Jim who works for the studios?" I wrote a script. And he says, you should try to reach him. And the pig says, reach him how? And he said, Jim, through his assistant. And the pig says, through her where? And the goat says, what's happening right now? And the pig closes his eyes and says, tell me it wasn't out a window. Have a little time to take a look at today in history. Today is Wednesday, July 23rd, the 204th day of 2025. There are 161 days left in the year. On this day in 1829, a prototype of the typewriter, called the typographer, was patented by William Austin Burt. On this day in 1840, the province of Canada, which combined Lower Canada and Upper Canada into a new region, was created by the Act of Union after being passed by the British Parliament. And on this day in 1883, Ulysses S. Grant, the 18th President of the United States and general who commanded the Union Army during the American Civil War, died at the age of 63 of throat cancer in Mount McGregor, New York. And on this day in 1914, Austria-Hungary issued a series of ultimatums to Serbia that included allowing Austria-Hungary to investigate who assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie, and demanded that Serbia cease all anti-Austrian propaganda and dissolve its nationalist organizations. Serbia agreed to all but one of the ultimatums. 3 days later, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, igniting World War I. And in 1962, on this date, Jackie Robinson made history again, becoming the first black player to be inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. And we've reached the end of the second hour of today's Arizona Republic. I'm Molly Mudick, your volunteer reader. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of a program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, under broadcast info and audio.